We might say the meanest things. Sometimes we're not much company. There's no rearranging. Our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, you belong to us. Pop
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 9 of the Pop Dose podcast. I'm Dave Lifton. We apologize for being a week late this month, but there were some scheduling issues that prevented us from getting together at the usual time. But we're going to make it up to you with this show. Later on, we'll be joined by Steve Almond, who is the author of a fantastic new book about being a music geek called Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life. But first, let me introduce my co-hosts, Jeff Giles and Jason Hare. Sup, fuckers?
Ho, ho, ho!
Sup, motherfuckers?
Happy Mother's Day!
You'll notice I said sup, motherfucker.
Oh, in honor of the day.
Yes, that even though yes. It is even though we're a week late, it is kind of fitting that we're recording today because the actual recording of this is on Mother's Day. Jeff, yours just left. She wanted to stick around for your call, but I had to kick her out.
Yeah, does anybody have any messages for Dave's mom? She wanted to make it to the call, but she's tied up. Yeah. I mean, she's literally tied up. She had me tied to the bedpost with some of my dad's old neckties. It's really kind of awkward, but she's right here.
The day before Mother's Day, my brothers and I celebrate a holiday, a family holiday. You might want to try this with your brother, Jason. Motherfucker's Day.
And what do you do on Motherfucker's Day? Wait, let me guess. It's your kind of holiday, so let me guess you drink.
That too. But no, we just call each other and say, you know, hi, motherfucker. Happy Motherfucker's Day.
And it's the only time they talk all year.
I keep trying to get Hallmark to make cards. But...
It's not the only time they talk all year. Jeff's brother is moving in with him.
Oh, he's here now. He's upstairs. He's only here temporarily.
That's what he says. I bet you we have this podcast a year from now. Your brother's still there.
We'll see how long it could take the kids.
Somebody to watch him.
That's true. But he might get so sick of him that he has to leave. It's like, I can't deal with this shit anymore.
That's my plan.
Okay. Well, my stomach is in revolt today, so if I run away, I don't usually drink, like, take any caffeine in, and yesterday I had two of those goo energy gels while I was biking, and then I had a Coca-Cola at a bar for some reason, and then I had a cappuccino later on in the night because I couldn't stay awake, and...
What the fuck?
I know, and then to eat, I had those deep-fried pickles from this bar, and then I had a burger, and then...
What is wrong
with
you?
Wait, let me finish. The deep-fried pickles and a burger, then Jessica and I shared some mac and cheese, and then we had cheesecake hours later, and I have to tell you, I feel awful.
What time did you go to bed?
3.
And you're up now for the podcast. You're a warrior.
I am a warrior. I am. I feel terrible.
A caffeine and fried food binge.
It's not what I usually do. I had never had these gels before, and I got home and I was like jittery.
What's really funny about this is that Jason had a ton of caffeine and some food that's pretty bad for him, and for me that's just breakfast.
I'm not used to this. I'm not used to the Dave Lifton diet.
Yeah.
The Dave Lifton diet.
Coffee and bacon.
Coffee and bacon, yeah. And
what a Jew.
And with a side order of ribs.
Nice. Nice.
So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, our guest Steve Almond has written a book about being an obsessive music fan, and that's gotten the three of us thinking about how we each became music geeks. So, and that's our topic for today, and let's start with Jason.
I can't recall the exact moment, but I guess it's fitting that we're recording this on Mother's Day because I think it's all because of my mom. My parents weren't real huge music listeners, but I do have some early memories of my mom playing records, on an evening or whatever, and
while she was rehearsing for her burlesque act,
right? Right. I just kept wondering why the only record she had was Big Spender. Strange. What's with that song, Mom? I remember she had Anne Murray and Air Supply, obviously, and Neil Diamond, and the one thing I specifically remember, the earliest record I remember looking at was an ABBA record, Super Trooper. I don't know. I guess I started to associate music with like hanging out with my family and just kind of, you know, hanging out and enjoying ourselves, and that's kind of at a young age what got me looking at records and reading the liner notes and just listening to music a lot. And actually, I was going to say it was years later before I formed my own musical opinions that weren't influenced by my mom, but I just listened to the new Air Supply record last week, so I would say I'm still stuck there.
I surprised your mom with tickets to an Air Supply show last night.
Yeah? How'd it go?
It was awful.
It was awful.
Yeah, because all night she kept whispering, love, sex, love, sex, kept waking me up.
Did you and bassist Johnny Lightfoot double team her?
Air Supply's heavy metal bassist.
That guy's awesome.
So the question is the review of the new Air Supply album going to be up on Pop Dos before the show does?
I don't know if we're going to do it, are we? We kind of beat it to death on Twitter.
That was beautiful. Both of you guys.
Yeah. I took my mom out to dinner on Friday for kind of an advanced Mother's Day thing, and I said, you know, I was going to get you the Air Supply album for Mother's Day, but I listened to it, and I don't think it would be an appropriate gift.
We should tell people why it would be inappropriate, because I guarantee most of the people listening to this have not heard the new Air Supply record.
Well, the first reason it would be an inappropriate gift is for Mother's Day, you want to give your mother something that shows that you love her, and this would be a gift showing her that I hate her because the album sucks.
But also?
Yes, but also there is a song called, which I had to tell her the title over dinner, which made me feel uncomfortable. The name of the song is called Love Sex, and it's like...
One word. It's one word.
One word, yes. And it's Air Supply trying to be, well, sexual. Oh, my stomach just turned. That's worse than the deep-fried pickles I had last night. It's just, the song is so disgusting. I think I said to my mom at dinner, I said, imagine, just listen, you'll have to listen to this song and imagine a naked, pear-shaped Russell Hitchcock.
I summed it up on Twitter as the human centipede of down-market adult contemporary songs. It's so gross. Unspeakably gross.
Great, gross is a great word for it. It's really, really terrible. I mean, they could have maybe gotten away with that kind of song when they were in their early 30s, you know, or late 20s, however old they were in the 80s. But in 2010, ugh.
It reminded me of that new Lita Ford record that's all about, you know, her being spanked or whatever. Yeah, yeah. But...
Air Supply trying to capitalize on Lita Ford's market, I think.
I'm impressed that they released a new album at all, because they don't need to release a new album. They do pretty well, I think, touring every year.
Do you remember reading the press release? I thought I read something about this supposedly being a concept album about a guy finding love in a parallel dimension or some bullshit like that.
I don't remember
that's
that.
What they did to get them to break out of their their spell. You know,
creative funk.
It's their Ziggy Stardust. Russell played guitar.
It's a concept album about a man going through his journey to find the worst music imaginable by guys who hung it up in the studio years ago. I found it. It's in Love Sex. The worst part of listening to the album was that one song I was like, oh, I remember this from when I saw them in concert. That was 2 years ago, and I was like, oh, why do I remember that? Think about the stuff I could store in my brain if I could get rid of that information.
I've always said that there's a part of my brain that could cure cancer that is being taken up with a fact like that. You know, like the knowledge that John Madden is afraid to fly or something like that. You know?
Yeah, my usual example for that is when I was in college, I was at a party one night, and Tell It to My Heart came on, and I hadn't heard the song in years, and I knew every word. So I always think about the Taylor Dane lyrics occupying the part of my brain that could be used for much better things.
Well, isn't Taylor Dane basically from your neighborhood? You probably have to know the lyrics.
Yeah, she's from Long Island, yeah.
She's from Long Island, along with... Deborah Gibson.
Who's from my school district, actually.
Yeah. D. Snyder.
Yep. Brian Setzer.
Also Long Island. Brian Setzer, there you go. Mm-hmm. Billy Joel, obviously. Yeah. Joan Jett, maybe?
All performers who graduated high school after Dave Lifton.
You old fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Joan Jett is claimed by both Long Island and the Baltimore, D.C. area.
Is she? A friend of mine runs the Long Island Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He kind of founded it or started it, so I believe they honored her last year or the year before.
Yeah, she's lived in both, but she's I think of her as being more Baltimore because she's a huge Orioles fan. So if as far as I'm concerned, if you're where you decide to consider yourself as a hometown is based on which is your favorite sports team.
Huh.
So if she's gonna say that she's an Orioles fan. Mm-hmm. Then to her, Baltimore is her hometown.
So I have no hometown.
I guess you don't.
I'm an orphan of the world.
I don't know. Where's Greg Louganis from? That's probably probably your hometown.
Jeff, did my dad tell you the story about the Greg Louganis joke that he made?
I don't think so.
You don't think so? My dad, I really shouldn't tell this story, but since I like to, you know, humiliate myself.
We can't let an episode of the show go by without a Gary Hare story.
This girl I was dating in high school after we broke up, for some reason, I heard through the line that she told people that that I was gay, which was preposterous. So I told I made the mistake, I think, of telling my dad about it or something.
Yeah, how could they ever get that
that notion?
Get that notion based on, you know, looking at your record collection. Air Supply and Ann Murray.
So I'm
Starlight Vocal Band's greatest hits.
Right. Shortly after hearing this story, I was telling some friends about it outside my house, and my dad opens the window and he goes, "Jason, phone call." And I go, "Who is it?" He goes, "Greg." I go, "Greg who?" And he goes, "Greg Louganis. He wants to know when you're coming over to play." Just, it was funny. It was unexpected. My dad tells that story all the time. to bring it all back, I get some of my musical influence from my dad. Like, my parents were big John Denver fans, and by extension, Starland Vocal Band fans. But I got really into music just kind of from my parents, and I watched The Jazz Singer, the Neil Diamond version, probably nonstop when I was 6 years old. I don't know why. I haven't seen it since, but I listened to that record nonstop, and then from there it was on to, I think it was on to Billy Joel from there, and then, you know, sky's the limit. So I don't know. I don't know if that really answers the question of how I became a music fanatic, but that's how I got into music, and I just. I don't know. It somehow seemed like both an audio and visual obsession for me. So,
when did you first hear "What a Fool Believes"?
Well, part of the reason I started writing that Mellow Gold series is because it reminded me of all the songs that I would hear on the radio. I think a lot of people feel this way. The songs that they would hear on the radio on, you know, the light FM stations as they were driving across the state or across the country, and we used to take trips. Up to upstate New York all the time, and I just remember all those songs. You know, "What a Fool Believes," "Into the Night," "Cool Night."
Ooh,
yeah, I know. So you just kind of pick up that stuff. It was never stuff that I really paid attention to. It was just comfortable. So that's how I kind of got into all that stuff.
Well, with me, one of the great things about this book that we're going to be talking about later is how in the very first chapter he lays out five criteria for becoming what he calls the drooling fanatic. And each one of them, I think, could be applied to my life and how I became one. You know, he says, have parents who are musicians. My mother is a very good singer, and so, you know, I guess genetically I got the love of music from her.
But not the voice.
No, not as much. My dad wasn't a musician, but I got the gene for obsessing about things and about your hobbies and stuff. That definitely came from him, and that's like why I would, like, when I would hear something I'd like, I would learn every lyric and read the liner notes, because that was the type of thing what he would do, and also, you know, knowing who played on what track and so on, those things. Then there was displaying just enough musical talent. That was the second criteria, and again, that was from my mother, who could play a little bit of piano, and we had a piano in the house, and, you know, she showed me how to read music and play chords and stuff. And I switched to guitar at 16, and that was turned out to be a much better fit for me. And number three, which I think is probably my favorite one, have an older sibling who thinks you're a dipshit. I have two older siblings, and they both think I'm a dipshit. But my oldest sister, I kind of gravitated towards her musical taste. And way back in 1976, there was a huge resurgence in interest in the Beatles, because I think there was a compilation that came out at that time.
I seem to remember that.
You were 2 years old. How could you possibly remember that?
I seem to remember reading about that.
Okay. It was in a history book.
Right.
Yeah. I guess that might have been like when maybe Elton John had a hit with Lucy in the Sky, and that had Lennon on the B-side. The I Saw Her Standing There on the B-side. I think that was in 76 around that time.
74, I think.
74? Okay.
I think, but
there was like one of the big capital reissues that came out, kind of brought back interest in it. And her and all of her friends, who I just thought were so cool, were listening to this group, and I kind of got into them through then. And, you know, that has stayed with me for almost 35 years now, as being an obsessive Beatles fan. The fourth criteria is a guardian angel. And Steve Almond mentions an uncle who had a great collection. I had an uncle on one side and an aunt on the other who turned me on some things to a small extent. But mostly it was like my friends, you know, who were discovering music at the same time, and we'd trade albums back and forth and duplicate cassettes, you know, and make mixes and stuff for each other, taping songs off the radio. So it was more my friends than an uncle or something, but they definitely helped.
And also, wasn't your babysitter Irving Berlin?
Wasn't your babysitter a caveman?
My babysitter also used to babysit Irving Berlin.
Stephen Foster.
And the fifth criteria is be lonely and spend your hours amid lonely. And I'm not going to comment on that. But, you know, we all know what that's all about. So
right.
That was kind of how I became a fan. And it just, you know, between playing guitar and just like learning, trying to learn all the songs that I was hearing and, you know, and break them down into, you know, how they fit, that kind of really influenced my musical taste in terms of being really interested in the craft of songwriting and like where my taste falls. The people who really know how to you know, put together a song and a chord structured in a very specific way that gets the intended emotional reaction, as opposed to something that just sounds like, you know, slapping a few chords together and, you know, over some words that you've written or something like that, or guys who just kind of get high and play play for hours. You know, that was never as much my style. Or sure. It was for a while. I did have a bit of a prog spell.
I never knew this about you.
Yeah, I did have a little bit of. It's funny because the Ballad of El Gudo by Big Star.
Yeah.
The chord that he sings that ends each verse before the chorus. The reason why I know that chord is from when I used to try to play Starship Trooper by Yes.
Jesus Christ, Dave.
The end, the that third chord, the way he plays the E flat is how I learned that chord was from Yes.
I had no idea.
It's hidden in my past. It's not a huge. I mean, I never owned a copy of Tarkus. Let's put it that way. But I did, you know, like some Yes and some ELP.
My prog rock begins and ends with one album by Genesis. Selling England by the Pound. That's it.
I thought you were going to say Invisible Touch.
Right, I can imagine Jason getting like Abacab and
Spazzing
the Genesis
out.
Album. And then like all of a sudden going back, and he gets to Selling England by the Pound. And he's like,
what the fuck is this?
What the fuck is this?
I like that you tied that all in with Steve's criteria for being a drooling fanatic. I felt really awkward when I read that part, because there was only the only of those five, the only one that I related to was being a musician myself, or, you know, or having some. I mean, he says that most drooling fanatics are not musicians, but, you know, have a little bit of musical talent. So I have that, but my parents have no discernible musical talent, like none.
Neither do you.
Thank you. I don't have an older brother who thinks I'm a dipshit, just a younger brother who probably now thinks I'm a dipshit, but I was the one who turned him on to music. I'd be interested in asking him about this, because I didn't think he was a dipshit, but I turned him on to all the music he listened to up until probably 11 or 12 years old. When I was into George Michael, he was into George Michael and Michael Jackson and Queen and Meatloaf. And
Oh, did you hear about Meatloaf's new album? I'm sure you did. Of course you did.
Hear about it? I listened to it.
Oh, I didn't listen to it.
Don't.
I heard him on I guess it was Weekend Edition, and oh god, it's horrible.
Yeah. You can edit this out, but it's going to be the subject of the new of the next You Again.
Oh, great! That's beautiful, because he was talking about it like it was the greatest thing ever.
It's god awful.
I think Meatloaf talks about everything as if it's, like, the greatest thing ever.
That's true.
This is the greatest deep-fried pickle ever! Right.
And he's a man who knows his deep-fried pickles.
I have to say, he's pretty charming in interviews.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
I find him to be a pretty compelling subject. But, yeah, the man can't sing, and...
I read his autobiography.
You did?
Yeah, he was charming in that, too.
I like watching clips of him in concert now when he sings, because he holds the microphone like he's jerking it off. He shakes it back and forth violently. And he can't sing for shit. He really can't.
Yeah, he's lost it. It's just, let's just belt every single note.
Right.
Oh, no. On the new album, he actually raps for a minute.
Yes, I did hear that, too. Ugh. I think that was when I was like, oh, my God, this is worse than I expected it to be.
I'm out.
Yeah. What's the new record called? Hang Cool Teddy Bear? Something stupid like that?
Yeah. Isn't Brian May on it? I think Brian May plays guitar on a little bit of it. Brian May. What did you do? What did you do? First Paul Rogers, now this.
Once you've rocked the cosmos, you know, there's nowhere to go.
One thing you got to give Brian May credit for? He found a haircut he liked, stuck with it.
That's a great point.
No matter
Dave.
How bad it was, he's just stayed with it his whole life.
He's like, I'm starting with the poodle, I'm ending with the poodle. Good call.
Lead singers come and go, but the poodle stays forever.
But the poodle remains.
That should have been the name of their album. His next solo album should be called that, The Poodle Remains.
Well, you know, he is pretty active online. I'm sure you could suggest that on a message board somewhere and he'd read it.
He's one of those online artists. He's like what Billy Joel was in the late 70s and early 80s. Like if anybody anybody criticizes him, he just rips him apart completely. Doesn't allow, like Kevin Smith is like that too. Doesn't allow anybody to have their own opinion that's negative of, you know, their music or whatever.
He's like Billy Joel. Didn't Billy Joel used to like rip up interviews on stage or reviews?
Yep, he used to read them right out of the newspaper and tear them up.
That's the way to endear yourself to critics, Billy.
Well, that was, I mean, the entirety of Glass Houses is pretty much a response to critics, isn't it?
Yeah.
If he really wanted to get back at them, why didn't he just offer to drive them home? What?
Nothing. I thought it was funny.
Okay, Jeff.
You know, for me, I think it was a combination of a little bit of what Jason talked about, just having a lot of records around the house. I don't remember either of my parents actually playing any vinyl, but they had stacks and stacks of it. And from a very young age, I would steal their records and play them on this little Fisher-Price record player that we had.
Ah, the Fisher-Price.
Yeah, the Fisher-Price record player. And my mother would, anytime she caught me, she'd yell at me because she claimed that it would ruin the records. But I would do it anyway. It was a combination of that, and I think what Allman went to, and you didn't really want to talk about, Dave, but kind of a childhood sadness, you know, like a, you know, wanting to be someplace else or wanting to be someone else. And that's probably, I think, why I gravitated toward Billy Joel's stuff so strongly, because of all the records that my parents had, I think his are probably some of the most melodramatic and probably he was probably more of a, for lack of a better term, more of a rock and roll storyteller than most of the other acts in their collection. Like, you know, there were the Eagles and Elton John and other artists that I can't think of right now.
But yeah, it's funny. I generally think of, I hadn't really thought of Billy Joel in those terms as like a melodramatic songwriter. I always thought of him, at least in my adult life, I think of him more as, and this is something we talked about a couple of years ago when I had you on my old show, was that for me, Billy Joel is a great gateway rock and roll musician.
That too. Definitely.
You know, and that he does combine like something like an Innocent Man, like somebody like the Drifters or Ray Charles only really existed on oldies radio and had no context. And then all of a sudden you hear that album and it's like, oh, okay, this is kind of where he's going with this. This is kind of sounds like that. And then that would get you to explore those other acts that he loved because he worked them so well into his own musical framework. And
yeah.
And also with some of his more intricate piano playing. I'm not going to say like his classical compositions, but some of the times where he's done more inventive piano work, you know, that kind of made sense of like somebody like Chopin for me.
I was only 9 when Innocent Man came out, so I didn't really appreciate the musical context of his experiments. But I think that lyrically,
I was in my 20s, so
he's always. I think from start to finish, his stuff is full of he always had a persecution complex, and he was always full of really, you know, righteous indignation, and his songs, by and large, are pretty sad. Innocent Man notwithstanding.
That's true.
You know, when you're 9 or 10 years old and you've got an unrequited crush or whatever, and you know, somebody like Billy Joel, I think, sums up those feelings pretty well.
Yeah, see, I didn't have that as a kid. I had that more as an adolescent in my teens, and then beyond that in college, which was, you know, the alternative heyday, you know, pre-Nirvana. So that was how I gravitated towards that, listening to The Replacements and Husker Du and R.E.M. and stuff.
Yeah, and that kind of gets, like, I think the negative.
One sec. Jason, R.E.M., The Replacements, and Husker Du were big alternative bands of the 80s.
If you say so.
The negative thing that I would say about Billy Joel here is that I think once you are kind of an adolescent or a young adult, that he... that his stuff is sort of
petulant
and shallow. You know, I don't think that he sums up. I think he does a better job of summing up kind of childish anger and Jason's going to interject here.
I think we talked about this back on Dave's old show, is that if you grow up on Long Island, or I don't think you're as aware of that stuff because Billy right. Joel is just treated like such a god. I mean, I know I've said this before. I didn't know that people didn't like Billy Joel until a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware
of
it.
But consider that something like, you know, Sleeping with the Television On, which is probably one of his deeper relationship.
That's his
songs.
Elvis. That's his Elvis Costello song.
Right, but he wrote that when he was 30. Like, just look at the lyrics and listen to the song.
Oh, sure.
And the, you know, the perspective.
They never noticed the zap gun in your hand.
See, I wasn't. You're more of a lyrics guy. I'm more of a music guy. And where you as a kid may have found solace in his lyrics. I like the fact that all three of us have this connection to Billy Joel in some way. What you mentioned to me made me remember was that as a kid, when my cousin gave me a copy of The Stranger, I wasn't listening to the lyrics of the song, but I was banging out scenes from an Italian restaurant pretending that my pillow was a piano. And that's why my parents got me a piano, because I had been listening to that album and was pretending to play the piano. And they thought,
they bought you a piano because they were tired of buying new pillows.
Right. Well, once you bang out
to buy
a pillow,
new pillows for all kinds of reasons.
Ah, the North Shore.
But I don't know if I felt necessarily lonely, like I had a bad life, but I did spend a lot of time as a kid pretending I was on stage, pretending right. I was a concert musician and pretending I was playing scenes from an Italian restaurant in front of an audience. That's where I went to with a lot of that stuff. So it wasn't for me. It wasn't about the lyrics. Yeah. And even now, I mean, I know all those lyrics by heart, but I don't know how many of them I've actually paid attention to, you know, or you know, said out loud and been like, "This is stupid," you know.
Yeah.
Other than "Où c'est à toi."
But I think, but Jeff, you definitely have a point there, and it goes back to the I think what I was saying about being a gateway. Once you hear it,
absolutely.
You know, better teen angst or adult angst songs done better, you do kind of take, you know, maybe that wasn't that great to begin with. But, you know, as Jason said, as a Long Islander, you know, I'll always defend him because mm-hmm. that was, you know, yeah. such a part of the life there.
Yeah, he was our artist. I mean, he mentioned Channel 13 in a song, you know.
He mentioned the Miracle Mile.
The Miracle Mile, exactly.
You know?
From the time when I really got into music, which was probably, I don't know, 82 or 83, up until maybe 1986, there was not a whole hell of a lot that I listened to besides Billy Joel. So I'm not really knocking him either.
And now apparently all you listen to is your kids banging upstairs.
Yeah, they're banging around upstairs again. God damn it. I still remember the thrill of buying Turnstiles on vinyl.
I remember getting the reissue of Cold Spring Harbor.
That too, yeah.
At the right speed?
Yeah.
I remember listening to the Russian concert in the back of my dad's car as we were going upstate over and over again and banging out Angry Young Man on the car seat.
I remember rushing home to catch the live broadcast of the concert in Russia.
That was around the time where my love affair with Billy Joel ended.
Really?
Yeah, I think the Russian live record's pretty weak.
Yeah, but mine ended a few years later when I discovered R.E.M.
Mine never ended.
I would have to say that ended.
Yeah. Jason's never ended.
I still listen to Billy Joel all the time. I think part of the reason that I think I mentioned this before too, the reason I haven't fallen out with Billy Joel is because as a rock, quote-unquote, piano player,
right?
You know, there's only so many artists that are predominantly piano, you know, based that you can play. So I play a lot of Billy Joel and Elton John still because that's the kind of stuff where the piano is such a lead instrument.
Right.
You know, and I never really got into Ben Folds. Also, I don't think I'm a good enough piano player to play that stuff. But there aren't a lot of other artists that are just all about the piano. I mean, when you think about rock bands where the piano is the lead, you think of Billy Joel and Elton John.
What about Randy Newman?
I don't think of Randy Newman.
Ah.
Jason doesn't like Randy Newman. I've tried getting him into it.
You are listening to Pop Toes.
Our guest today is Steve Almond. He's a former music critic who has written an incredible new book called Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life, and it's in stores now. Steve Almond, welcome to the Pop Toes podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the... I think that's kind of a pity clap. And I thank you for it.
That's our studio audience.
That's
oh,
right.
That's a studio audience.
That's a we have no budget for sound effects clap.
I like it.
What we should do is we should next time I should isolate the sound of Jeff's kids banging on the stairs and add it in post production.
You really don't need to do that. You don't need to do that because I got my own kids that you'll undoubtedly hear downstairs. They're raging right now.
Okay.
Steve's kids are raging. Jeff's kids are banging. What the hell is going on here?
Jason, how come your neighbors aren't having sex?
My neighbor downstairs, the baby's crying.
Okay.
I can hear that.
Well, how do you know the baby isn't having sex?
That's a great point. Well, Jeff's kids are banging, so who knows?
So, Steve, what was the impetus for writing the book?
Well, my career, such as it is, it sort of traces whatever I'm obsessed with. So first book was about kind of romantic disaster, fucking up, the kind of what you do in your late 20s and early 30s, if you're me, and you haven't had enough therapy yet. And then, you know, I wrote a book that was about candy, which was really just about my obsession with candy. And I really think the natural path of people's consciousness is obsession and confession. Those are pretty much the two natural ways that consciousness moves if you don't, you know, if your defenses aren't properly aligned. And so I kind of have just been writing about all the stuff that I really care about and one way or another can't get rid of by other means. So I've been obsessing over collecting music, writing about it, thinking about it, trying to figure out from music how to learn how to write, proselytizing to people, being kind of crazy and creepy and evangelical about the bands and artists that I love for, you know, since I was 10, or younger probably. But the idea of then writing about it, I think it might have taken me a while because I just thought it's almost like, well, that's just like writing about oxygen. You know, it seemed to me such an intuitive part of how I moved through the world that the idea of writing a whole book about it just was like I finally had to realize, oh, well, I should probably be writing about this since it keeps showing up in all my work and in little ways. I should probably write about this in a bigger way. And honestly, I also think that the most interesting, like I've had a pretty boring life, just to put it bluntly. It's not been like dramatic things have happened. I've lost. I've loved. It's like a super boring suburban life. But in a sense, you know, most people, 99, not you guys, because you're crazy, you're madmen, but most people have really had pretty boring lives. We don't lead the big Hollywood, you know, lots of death and lots of turmoil and it's, you know, going off to war. And, you know, we mostly just kind of schlump around in our underwear trying not to suck. So for me, the way that I'm able to kind of get into the parts of my life that are, to me, feel more important and significant is just through looking at something very concrete and specific, like candy or failed relationships or music. And that's sort of the way that I recognize that all those years I spent in El Paso or Miami or Greensboro, North Carolina, weren't just boring, pathetic, you know, dumb movies that would put you to sleep, but there was a lot of interesting stuff going on in those years emotionally and psychologically. So, you know, I pretty much, the short answer is I ran out of other things to write about.
Okay. How did you come up with the term drooling fanatic? Because I think that that's one of the, just, you know, condensing music geekdom into that phrase, drooling fanatic, I thought was a masterstroke of the book.
Really? Wow. Okay. Well, I'm glad because it was not me. Actually, I had a bunch of different tags for it. You don't know. You don't want to go with music geek, which is super fan, feels too marketing-y. And I was trying to kind of get at sort of how regressed we feel when the presence of music we love, like all, it really just sends us back to a very kind of pre-verbal childlike state, does for me, as evidenced by like how you try to sing along or how you might try to dance when music's happening. You know, you just look like a dork. You look like a kid, frankly, an unselfconscious kid in the best moments. So I had originally had this term dirty fanboy, which was my lame effort to kind of make it sound edgier or something. And then I sent the book down to, I sent a little excerpt of the book down to a friend of mine, Tom DeMarkey, who's a writer also.
I know
he
Tom.
Said, oh, you know,
yeah,
Tom?
Yeah, I know him from the Elvis Costello listserv that we were on for years and years
I
and
see.
Years.
All right. So what's your, do you have a homosexual in the park encounter with Tom DeMarkey story? Well, okay, we can get to that later.
Doesn't everyone?
I just know him through emails.
I hear you. You're too inhibited. That's all right. I gotcha.
No, I just don't like Florida.
I understand. So anyway, so I sent this book down, and there's this term, I abbreviated it, DF, and Tom sends me a note back saying, I really like this chapter, blah, 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 but what is this term DF? What does that stand for? Drooling fanatic? And I was like, yeah, I guess it does. I liked it because it implied, like I'm saying, that it's almost something limbic. When you really love a band, you're not just a fan. That's, you know, you're more than that. You really get obsessed and almost, in my case, definitely creepily so. And then also the idea that it's just a reaction you can't control. So drooling fanatic seemed to kind of condense that. And I thought it was, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what my editor thought of it. It's not the usual thing that you would call a fan. It's sort of asking people to go along with something. And I'm sure there's people out there who are like, yeah, this book's kind of interesting, but why the dumb drooling fanatic thing? For whom I have no answer other than it's Tom DeMarkey's fault.
All right, guys, anything?
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about this little brouhaha that erupted over the excerpt from the book that published before it came out.
I think you mean there was an op-ed that ran in the Boston Globe about music criticism?
Yes.
Right. So that was not at all an excerpt from the book. It was an op-ed I wrote independently, although some of the ideas are congruent with the ideas in the book. I actually think that the op-ed, because it's an op-ed, is written a little bit more bluntly. In the book, the essential point I make is it's really, and you guys know this, it's really hard to write about music. It's its own language, and it's a, for the most part, melody and rhythm are much more physical and intuitive, and they're emotional. They're aimed at our emotional systems. So when you hear a great riff, you know, you can sort of try to explain it to somebody, but that's going to be, you know, 1/1000th of 1% as effective as just playing it for them. And so in the book, I try to make the point that as I was going through being a lousy music critic, I was really, even if I'd done a good job, even if I'd had a technical training in music, even if I'd known about the bands and the history of those bands and where they fit into the, you know, particular, how they sort of reflected the larger musical culture, even if I had done all that homework and been a better writer than I was in El Paso in the early 90s, you know, late 80s, early 90s, I was still up against something much bigger than what a, even a brilliant prose stylist can manage, which is how do you convey what music feels like to a particular fan? And it's really, if you think about it, and I'm not saying anything, this is not a criticism of any critics. It's really, in a sense, sympathetic to what they're up against. You cannot possibly explain to somebody what the opening riff of Back in Black sounds like. And then even if you could, you can't explain what it would be like to hear that song in concert to that 13-year-old who grew up in La Crosse, Wisconsin, who, you know, who knows vaguely of the poverty of their own prospects and how angry and confused they are by the world and how much they need in that particular moment Angus Young to just absolutely bang out those chords and the rest of the band to play that sort of larger song around it, because that's a completely personal, intuitive experience that that kid is having. And a critic, I think, good critics, I think, can do lots of useful things, but especially when it comes to music, it's, I think they're up against this sort of ontological impossibility that they can somehow convey what it feels like. And I saw that very clearly when I was writing about bands that I just didn't cotton to at all. They just struck me as sort of bogus or phony or idiotic. A lot of heavy metal bands, you know, I was reviewing heavy metal bands in El Paso. It's all these hair metal bands. So it wasn't even that, like, quote unquote, good heavy metal. It was like Poison and Vixen and Kiss Without Makeup, and, you know, that whole long laundry list, Winger and Queensryche. And, you know, those guys were like drag queens. They're up there and they're like these sort of weird, superannuated, masculine, and yet somehow incredibly feminine figures preening around, and kind of, you know, screeching about whatever they were screeching about. And I'm just sitting there going, man, this is just bogus. This is just like some kind of weird sort of misogynist cabaret or something. But then I would look around me at, you know, fifth row or fourth row, and you see these kids and they are banging, man. They are feeling the cheesiest, most idiotic anthem from your critical perspective. They are feeling so purely and so intuitively, and it is so obviously a big, important emotional event within their bodies, a physical seismic event. And how, as a critic, are you supposed to even get close to that? That's what I was really trying to suggest. And of course, it's an op-ed, so I had about 500 or 600 words to convey that. And, you know, also, I think that music critics, like any other kind of art critic in the press, they have a harder and harder job because it's so easy now for people to just see a video on YouTube or to get a bootleg of the show on the internet. So the one unassailable purpose that reviewers had in the past, which is, you know, as sort of consumer guides, is almost entirely eliminated. You just hold up your iPhone and you can, you know, get the name of the song and maybe even get 2 or 3 live versions of it within 30 seconds. So they're feeling, I think, very insecure. The media in general is a profession where people are feeling incredibly insecure, and am I going to have a job next week? So to have an obnoxious so-and-so like me come along and say, hey, you know, music critics are totally worthless. I don't know if I mentioned this. Of course they're going to be teed off about it. I don't blame them at all. But I also think that if they're being honest with themselves, their job is, by some objective standard, kind of like impossible and maybe even I'm going to use myself as an example. I see a lot of music critics who respond to that dilemma and also to their own basic envy about not being musicians by just assuming a hypercritical, dismissive, how much can I make fun of the band or be dismissive of what they're trying to do sort of attitude. And that to me is not just bad criticism. That's just being a shitty person.
Right. We talk about this on the site sometimes and talk about the way that criticism has changed from the way it was during the Winger era when the gatekeeper was still there, you know, that was still, yeah, the critic's function. And he was essentially kind of talking down the mountain to his audience.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But now it's more of a two-way stream. Like, you know, even with this book, you know, you're essentially broadcasting a message, and it's not really a conversation, but you include the CD. I mean, the mix that people can download, and you're on Facebook, and you're just kind of in it more with your audience, the same way writers are at a site like ours, where, like you say, YouTube is right there. You can embed an MTV video. You can embed a La La playlist for the time being, anyway, and you can create a conversation about art instead of trying to guide people, I guess.
Yes. No, that's absolutely true. But you all know what I'm talking about when I refer to a music critic. I mean somebody like Chris Gow or whoever it is who thinks, I'm the guy.
Right.
You know, I'm the guy. I'm the arbiter of what's good and what's bad. And to me, that's the other thing that's just so absurd. I mean, you know, I agree, obviously, that there are certain pieces of musical art that I think are transcendent and beautiful, and that's why I write about the musicians that I write about in the book at length. And I agree that we can sort of agree that, you know, Toto's lyrics in I Bust
That was my next thing,
Africa,
was it?
Right, you know, that song is, while the guys in Toto think it's a very heavy spiritual comment and an effort to connect with the plight of the African continent, and I'm kind of proud of them for recognizing that Africa is in fact a continent as opposed to a large country. So we can sort of, you know, agree that Toto is that's really just Muzak and imperialism mashed up, that it's this completely absurd, poorly written, cheesily produced song. And yet at the same time, when I play that song, you know, if I'm reading from the book, because I always play music when I'm doing readings from the book, you know, people love it.
Yeah.
And you see them, you see this incredible weird thing happen where their bodies immediately go, do, yeah, I remember this for a while, man, this thing's awesome. I'm feeling tribal. I'm getting back to my roots. And then you see the part of them kick in that's like, oh my God, that's Toto. And then the shame spiral starts and they're like, oh God, I know I shouldn't like this song. And then Almond's up there telling them how stupid it is. And so they start to hate themselves for loving the song, but they still love the song, you know? So it's the reason that I think it's so dopey to sort of say, well, this is good music and this is bad music. What I think you can say, and what I think sort of makes the most sense, is to say, here's what this music evokes for me. Here's what emotions it brings up. Here's what experiences it's linked to. And that's, to me, the kind of the most interesting writing about music, is all the way music serves and songs serve as kind of emotional transport devices.
Yeah, I want to read now from the book your analysis of the lyrics and what it actually When looking at it line for line, this is what Steve came up with.
Okay. Says,
"Dear drought plague continent," he is saying, "you really remind me of this chick I want to sleep with.
Yeah.
Something about you, maybe it's the wild dogs or the ancient melodies of the starving children I watch on TV, makes me realize I've been working too hard. I need to give myself more time to do and consume things with my lady, who I wish would get here already. In return, I bless your reins."
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when I found the letter, because I was like, what possessed these people? I could have done a million of these reluctant exegeses, right? And part of the reason I limited it to a couple of them is because, you know, it's kind of fish in a barrel. The world of pop music is full of dopey lyricists who, and in the end, you know, you don't even, people don't even really listen to the words. They just know if it's a good groove and a good melody. But you sort of look at the words, and this was one where it was so astonishingly clear that the artists had maxed out on the credit card of their own talent. You know, they were just so far out of their depth. Like, and this guy is like talking about the genesis of the song, David Page, the bassist, I guess. And he's like, yeah, so I was watching this ad on TV and I saw this, you know, the poor kids in Africa. And I was like, man, I feel bad about that. I gotta get myself over there. But rather than being like, I should take a plane or I should send money or, you know, I should really involve myself in a significant way with the suffering of other people that I am now made aware of by this late night TV commercial. His immediate impulse is, I should write a song that puts me in Africa. But it won't just be about Africa. It'll be about this chick that I want to get laid by. And, you know, and it'll be kind of, I'll meet an old man and there'll be some dogs. I should probably mention Kilimanjaro. And you can just see, I mean, it's such an American set of attitudes. And so that's the only reason that it's worth writing, you know, that it was worth writing the exegesis. It's partly just to have fun. I want it to be a funny, you know, I want it to not be a pretentious book about like music, and I hate those kind of books where you're like, dude, the whole point is to let your ass out of the ass cage. It's music. This should be a fun, you know, experience. So that's the, you know, I wanted to have some fun with it, but I also felt like that song in particular really does speak to particular American pathologies, a sense of sort of entitlement and not even seeing how imperialist your mindset is, and sort of thinking that you're, you know, watching TV and feeling bad for those kids with flies crawling on them makes you, you know, actually affects some good in the world or makes you benevolent just by having those feelings. And that's something I think that's sort of threaded through the book. I wouldn't praise Paradise Theater by Styx as a classic album, as a classic piece of beautiful art. But I do think that it's basically the soundtrack for the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, that it really does reflect what it was like to be alive in that time, the kind of phony nostalgia, this sort of self-regard that the Reagan era was all about. And, you know, if you really want to know what it was like to be alive at that time, you really shouldn't listen to Sandinista or U2's October, all the sort of seminal records. You should listen to Paradise Theater, even if that's painful, because you know what? It was a really dark, painful, phony time in this country's history, in my view, anyway.
The sense of entitlement thing, I think, works pretty well, because I think that if I was... if I was fucking Rosanna Arquette at that time, I would have a sense of entitlement as well.
But you gotta wonder if anybody ever asked David Page whether he sent any of the proceeds from the massive sales of that record down to any kind of charitable organization. Because you know he did. It all went up his nose.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, I guess his answer would be, well, I felt I was supporting the economies of Latin and South America.
The Toto Foundation.
Exactly. I mean, Medellin... Where do you think those, you know, great big buildings and new ball fields came from down in, you know, in Medellin? I mean, that was me. I was the consumer, man. I was. So
I got to say, you know, I agree with you about the critic does have a pretty impossible job or a thankless job. But I do think that in a lot of places in this book, a lot of it's very funny and a lot of it's kind of glib. But a lot of it is also really, really beautiful. When you really get caught up in describing the way these artists make you feel, I think you come close to surmounting that wall that we have critics behind. That you come close to bridging that gap. And my hallmark for good music writing is when somebody can write something that makes me care about an artist that I know I don't really particularly like.
Yeah, you know, well, I appreciate that. That's what I was certainly trying to do. And there's that beautiful passage by Fitzgerald where I was like, oh, my God, like, it's really hard to write well about music.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to put a passage in so people didn't think it was impossible. But it's not that you're writing with such technical proficiency about the music.
It's emotional.
You're writing about how the music, yeah, it's how the music makes people feel.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, what the kind of... this almost religious, it is religious. I mean, that's why music is basically what's kept religion alive, I think, is people need to go somewhere and, you know, sing together in a room. And, you know, so for me, I'm always trying to capture those moments that, and they're not hard to remember because I remember them. They're kind of what I remember of my time in El Paso or Miami or wherever I was. you know, where a particular song just absolutely takes you back to a particular moment and how it felt to be that age or enmeshed in that kind of romantic disaster, whatever extreme feeling state the music suddenly made manifest inside you. Because that's what music does. It allows you to reach feelings that are inaccessible by other means. And so for me, to write about music is essentially the same thing as saying, well, all right, I'm just going to write about my emotional life. But it's very much, and I don't expect people to have listened to the song like Suddenly by the Bogmen. Like one out of a zillion people has ever heard that song. So it's my job to try to convey with the context of what was going on in my life why that song meant so much to me. A little bit about what it sounds like, but mostly about sort of what it made me feel at that particular point in my life.
Well, I think that's what makes your book so unique is and so fantastic is your willingness to expose your own vulnerability. I mean, you really put yourself out there naked in a lot of this book. And that's kind of what I know that's what makes me care about listening to this music is that you're so willing to put yourself out there.
Yeah. Well, that's what people want. I mean, you guys know because you sort of are swimming in it. It's all marketing out there. You know, it's all trying to get people to the next buy. And while we're sort of inundated by these buy messages, people are starving to death. They are so lonely. They're so isolated. They're so sort of their umbilical cord emotionally is Facebook or whatever it is. We're all basically sitting in front of screens almost all the time, dying of loneliness. And, you know, this desire to, it's really the fantasy of making music, I think, to feel that people are going to, you know, that we're expressing ourselves, that we're going to be loved for the beauty of that self-expression. It happens to almost nobody, but it's everybody's dream. And, you know, in a sense, there's tons of books out there about half of them written by Neil Strauss, it seems to me, that are about, you know, rock bands and rock stars, right? When he's not writing brilliant books about, you know, how to pick up women and treat them sadistically, he writes about rock stars who do that and make music too. And, you know, there's a zillion of those books out there. That's what our sort of body of, there's sort of those books, and then they're the very sort of haughty, critical, looking down from the ramparts of their critical knowledge and trying to tell you how you need to listen to Bob Dylan sort of books. And I'm like, that really is not the kind of book that people need about music. What they need is a book that identifies the crazy happiness and depression and anguish and anxiety and doubt and joy that actually music awakens inside everybody. And while I'm writing about my experiences, my hope is that as people are reading the book, in a sense, they're just writing their own book. You know, they aren't thinking about Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor. You know, they're thinking about Black Boys on Mopeds or whatever. They're thinking about a Gillian Welch song or some other song that for them was the thing that takes them back to their low point as an adolescent.
Absolutely.
You know, so like my wife's experience with Fade to Black, you know, I mean, that song kind of saved her life. It's a very dark song. It's very angry. I think the lyrics are probably, you know, technically at the level of like a stone 10th grader trying to articulate why he's so unhappy. But you know what? We're all stone 10th graders when it comes to that kind of anguish. And, you know, my wife, I wrote this sort of, you know, again, kind of mean, funny, isn't Metallica dopey exegesis of that song. And when my wife, you know, I read it to her and I was kind of expecting she would laugh and everything. And she was like, yeah, you know, let me tell you a little bit about, like, I love that song, she said to me. And I was like, oh, really? And then she started talking about what that song meant to her, you know, when she was a kid growing up with very strict parents and how much she needed that music to feel all the stuff inside her, the anger and the resentment and the desire to sort of escape somehow, even if it was through suicide, even if it was through the fantasy of suicide. And it was really this sort of beautiful human story. And I thought, oh, what am I doing fucking around just teasing Metallica? This is a perfect opportunity for me to try to write about, you know, the way that we're all totally laid bare emotionally when we're listening to music, or at least those songs that, and bands that meant the most to us. So that's completely was my goal, was to, you know, write about the experience of being a fan and somebody who listens to music and somebody who's susceptible to that kind of deep feeling when they listen to music.
Have Aaron's parents read the book?
You know, I don't think they have. They're not big readers, and I think by design, even if they had, I'm not sure that they would say anything. But the thing is that they're the sort of people who are kind of freaked out that she's, because she's a writer also, so they're sort of freaked out that she's, you know, become a writer and that she married this, like, crazy communist Jew guy who does, you know, I do write, because they're politically also, you know, much further to the right. And so there are a lot of areas where we just don't go there. And one of them is my books. And that's fine, because in a sense, I don't, the one thing I was frightened about and the reason that I really sort of, I ran it past my wife, I edited it according to her instructions, and I really pulled back on talking too much about the specifics of what went down when she was growing up, because I do put it all out there, because I think that's what people want. We have enough of that bullshit out there, enough of that advertising. You know, they want to know, they really want to know who to care about, and they want to know what that person cares about, and that, you know, then they'll follow along. And at the same time, I recognize that that's not the way that everybody leads their life, that everybody, usually for good reason, has their defenses. And, you know, so I wouldn't want to feel that, you know, like Aaron's relationship with her parents would be adversely affected, or my, you know, they're the grandparents to my kids. So, you know, I definitely wanted to write that in a way where I felt like, I hope anyway, that I was being sympathetic to everybody who was in that situation, because, you know, it wasn't easy for Aaron's parents to see their daughter, who was a straight A student, who was so obedient, who was, you know, church going and memorized the names of the saints, and suddenly at 12, 13, 14, she's like this wild-eyed, you know, young woman who's dressing in tight jeans and kind of tarting herself up with makeup and listening to this music that to them must have been totally terrifying, and really against the belief system that they had. And the point isn't to say that they're, you know, provincial dopes, or, you know, that she was out of control. It's that dynamic of an adolescent needing and needing a larger world than the one they've been given, you know, by their parents, has been repeated over and over and over again a zillion times. And there's always music that allows that adolescent to feel the feelings they have to feel in order to get through it.
We've been talking a lot about the kind of the universal power of music. And one of the things that I enjoyed about the book, as somebody who has interviewed a lot of artists, is that you get at the heart of the drooling fanatic kind of worship of these people who wield that power.
Yeah.
But you're also pretty frank about the disappointment of
oh, yeah,
meeting these people, yeah, and realizing that they're just people.
Yeah. Well, that's it. They don't write, you know, you guys have to do, I would imagine, lots of profiles and interviews and stuff. And you can't really write about it. You can't step back and say, this is this weird, totally phony, but you wish it was real kind of interaction, where, like, you know, Edie Brickell doesn't really want to be talking to me, dork reporter from the El Paso Times. You know, it's not like she's like, hey, I wonder what that reporter's up to. I want to, you know, hang with him. It's part of the contract. It's part of the obligation. It's the media thing you have to do. And then, you know, on the other side of it, I don't necessarily want to be talking to Kip Winger. I know my wife would love to be talking to Kip Winger right, and giving him a boner, but no, I don't want to be talking to Kip Winger. And yet I've got to, because I need to get the good story. And, you know, that's a totally ulterior relationship. And so what I was always reaching for, and I'm sure you guys feel the same way, is some way to get at the authentic person, to, like, make a real connection that transcends how patently ulterior and artificial the discussion really is, you know. And so, I mean, the epitome of that was trying to talk to Dave Grohl and,
yeah,
recognizing, you know, how completely bizarre, because I'm not a national music writer guy, you know, I'm basically a short story writer who's, you know, who writes some nonfiction also. And so for me to be sort of thrust into this, like, national rock journalist world with Dave Grohl and all the people around him, it's like, I'm not Chuck Klosterman, I don't do that for a living, like, I have no idea how it operates. But in a certain way, that made me acutely aware of how bizarre the whole experience was, and how sort of unexpectedly real and almost poignant Dave Grohl was in how much he confessed about sort of what really goes on in his life. But meeting these more obscure rock stars who I worship was, you know, must have been terrible for them, because at the same time that I'm like, Ike Riley, you're the best thing ever. Nobody gets that you're like the Dylan for our generation. You're like the Pogues and Dylan, and you know, you're the, you know, and he sort of is hearing that, and at the same time he's like, yeah, thanks. But also, what are you doing in my house? You're weird and crazy and hyper, and you're not from Rolling Stone. And two, I already know that I'm not as popular as I should be. I already know that I'm not being recognized, and your drooling fanaticism is only reminding me that I am not getting my due as an artist. So there was this weird dynamic where, on the one hand, they were very flattered to have me there, and on the other hand, I was both making them nervous by being kind of getting inside the tripwire as a fan, because they were like, wait a second, you're just a fan, aren't you? You know, it's like at a certain point, all of them got this look on their face like, so wait a second here, you seem like a crazy stalker fan and you're in my house, you know? Like, Ike Riley was like, didn't want us to go in certain areas of his house, which I don't, you know, I totally don't blame him. Dana Kirst was like, hey, maybe you should relax and get to sleep and not like wander around my, you know, my cabin up in Vermont. So there was this weird kind of what's the Glenn Close movie, you know,
Fatal Attraction
in all these interactions where they're like, uh-oh, wait a second, I've got like a nutbag in my house. But at the same time, these guys and women are, you know, it's really very tragic to be a great artist and to work so hard. Most of these guys are in their 30s and 40s, to have worked so hard for so long to make really great art, to not just sell out and make the kind of pop music that would have made them successful. They're constitutionally incapable of doing that, and that's what's so great about them. But it also is a painful thing to feel like you're not getting across to the audience that you would like to, and you still have to work so hard to raise the money to make the next record, you know? So I think I was reminding them of those things. And also, I think the fact that they were really great musical artists, and this is my benighted version of being a musician, I just assumed because they were almost like, to me, superheroes who could do this magic thing of making music, I just assume, based on how happy music makes me, that they must just walk around on the clouds, you know, just shitting roses. They just must be delighted to be musicians. But, of course, they're artists, and everybody who's trying to create is, at least it's been my experience, sort of choked with doubt and status anxiety and an ultimate doubt as to whether all the deep work they do and all the unbearable feelings they uncover inside themselves and commemorate in these songs is really worth it. You know, that's tough work. As much as they might be casual about it, it must not be easy for, you know, Joe Henry to go to the dark space that's required to write a song like Short Man's Room, or for James McMurtry to write a song like Rachel's Song, where they're basically saying, this is what it must be like to be this utterly broken and wounded, and I'm going to try and capture it in a song. But it doesn't sound real unless they've really been through it, you know, unless the emotions that they've fed into that song are authentic feelings of grief and anguish and all the other sort of dark, turbulent stuff. So I think it's by way of saying most artists have a pretty significant dark side.
At least good ones.
Right, and then there are people, you know, then there are people, yeah, there are people like, for instance, Air Supply, who are like, my dark, you know.
We were talking about him earlier, so.
Yeah, he's special. Both of them. I'm not sure, actually. I think there might just be two of the same guy. But anyway, I think there's two of them. But, you know, like, All Out of Love is this song where, you know, it's sort of supposed to be about a guy feeling his deep man pain, but then you sort of look at what he's actually saying, and he's basically saying to a woman that he dumped after emotionally neglecting her for many months, like, hey, why aren't we together anymore? What happened? And furthermore, we should be together, and I'm like, I might off myself if we don't get together. You know, in other words, I think that it's fair to say that this is good art because, you know, the lyrics and the music feel, and maybe in some ways are like operate almost like when I read it, you know, listen to a good song, it's like poetry to me, or it's like really good short storytelling in a condensed version. They blew up the Chicken Man in Philly last night, then they blew up his house too. You know, it's just a great line.
Yep.
And it, you know, the fact that those people aren't stringing together cliches, you know, and so forth is, is a testament to the fact that they're in it for the right reasons, but that doesn't mean that they're going to get popular. And in fact, I would argue there's an inverse relationship. It's more likely if their stuff is real and nuanced and doesn't fit into some neat radio-ready category, there's a, you know, better than not chance that they're going to be less successful because they've tried to make real art.
See, Jason, our guest agrees that Bruce is better than Air Supply.
Just barely.
We talk about this a lot on the podcast because I grew up with all that mellow rock and soft rock and stuff like that. And I'm personally pissed that you, for the first time in my life, you made me pay attention to the lyrics of that song because I grew up with that stuff. And I also kind of wish you had looked at Making Love Out of Nothing at All. Instead of that, a good, I think you would wreak serious havoc on a Jim Steinman.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's so many. It was tough to decide. Making Love Out of Nothing at All. Yeah, but I feel like the book should come with like a warning, like a label, like warning. You know, if you hate the following songs, they're going to be like stuck in your brain pan for like 3 weeks after you read this book, and that's one of them. All Out of Love. But, you know, I think they're amazing. And this is the thing that is so blessed about music. A song like Easy, you know, by the Commodores with Lionel Richie is just like somehow has made that miraculous leap for me. It has somehow transcended cheesiness and just gone straight into pure pleasure. And even these songs that I write about hating, I really don't entirely hate. There's some part of me, even though I don't have respect for them, I'd still sleep with them, you know. I don't have any respect for these songs, but I would fucking, you ready, let's do it, you know.
That's one of the things that I've and some that I've talked a lot about is on this show over the months that we've done it, the idea of nostalgia being used for ironic purposes by mm-hmm. hipsters. And one of the things that we at Popdos have done a lot, especially like, and I've written this about Jason loving the mellow artists and some of the stuff that the older acts from the 80s, is that we don't take that approach. We don't, you know, we look at it as, yes, part of our growing up and our childhood, and we do have that nostalgia aspect, but we love it on an unironic level. And I think that's one of the things that you get to when you talk about Easy, that there is, you can look at it and say, okay, it's cheesy, it's mellow, it's this, but there's also a real sense of craft in there that Lionel Richie really did bring to a lot of his stuff, even if it does come out as cheese.
I feel the same way about Tarzan Boy by Baltimore. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, there's so many songs. There's so many songs where you can certainly go, oh, I mean, there's the easy thing to do is to be dismissive and say, oh, yeah, you know, it's so cheesy, da, da, da. Or, oh, yeah, that, in some superficial way, oh, yeah, that reminds me of, like, you know, XYZ, summer camp. And the thing is, people talk about nostalgia as if it's, I think what I'm really aiming at in the book is not so much nostalgia as identifying how it felt to be alive at particular times in my life. And it's not, you know, it's not always exalted. A lot of the time it's really painful. You know, when I'm writing about my wife listening to Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor and, you know, how it feels to hear that song now, it's a song that's sort of tinged with a kind of delicious sense of heartbreak, you know, of when she was most alive as a 15-year-old, which is when she was, you know, whatever, just had her heart broken and she's in the CVS putting the nail polish on the shelf and just that song comes on the stereo in the store and she's just like, God, I am just heartbroken. Only Sinead understands. So in a sense, it's like, I get that irony. I get that sometimes I'm ironic and blah, blah, blah. But as a posture, I just think it's way too late in our history as a species to be dismissing our deepest feelings. And people are living so far away from their feelings that it's like they don't need any more irony. We're full up with irony. We get it. Ha ha, Letterman, right? What we need is, you know, what we need is to start to take ourselves and our feelings and our emotional responsibility for other people's feelings more seriously. That moment on David Letterman is the quintessential moment where that was really hammered home to me, where there's Willie Nelson and Dave saying, ah, you know, sing us a song, you old stoner. And Willie Nelson takes him at his word and says, even though this is a low ebb in Willie Nelson's career and he's just made like six bad movies and, you know, fucked a groupie with Julio Iglesias at the same time, whatever. It was not a good time in his career. But, you know, he opened his mouth and just started singing, and the entire room, the David Letterman irony complex, just was shattered just by the sound of Willie Nelson's voice. No instruments, just his voice. And that, I think, is... I guess I just don't always feel comfortable with the idea of this. It's being nostalgia. It's more like, hey, people actually have, even if they have boring lives, they have really fascinating internal lives. And music is the one secret passageway. It's not even a secret passageway. It's the one public way that people can return to those feelings. And that's why when I listen to the Commodores, I just feel a certain kind of joy that is uncomplicated. It's a 9-year-old joy. It's when I was first listening to those songs. And at the same time, you know, the guitar riff with that weird effect, I think it's guitar, on Easy is just an absolutely gorgeous sound. You know, every single critic on earth could take a baseball bat and smash into that solo and it would not make a dent. It's just a, you know, unassailably beautiful sound. I so feel that I know this is kind of pretentious or didactic, but I so feel that we're living in a time where America and Americans are making so many terrible choices, so many self-regarding, angry, defensive choices in the way that they construct reality. And music, to me, is the one thing this country has totally done right. And sort of an undercurrent of the book is my effort to sort of remind people that as much as we might suck and be selfish and hate people of color and hate women and hate homosexuals and hate anybody who doesn't, you know, conform to our sense of what's right and what's in the Christian Bible, not the Christian Bible where God, you know, Jesus is homeless and a pacifist, but the one where he hates gay people and thinks that the wealthy deserve to be wealthy, that Christ. Like, there's a whole wing of the country, a whole... sort of large population that to me is just pathological right now. And I have to almost remind myself that America also produced, you know, Miles Davis and Frank Sinatra and, you know, Ornette Coleman and Marvin Gaye and the Hold Steady and Ike Riley and Dana Kurtz and Joni Mitchell. You know what I mean? I have to go, wait, we're the worst country on earth ever, I think, in many ways, but we're also the best. And the evidence, the clearest evidence, is how much incredible music has come out of. And really what it is, to me, is this incredible immigrant energy and all the different kinds of music that get fed into a guy, a genius mind like Bob Dylan's, you know, so that, you know, midway through his career, he's making so many different kinds of music that come from so many different kinds of influences that are the best of kind of what America is. All right, I'm off the soapbox. I just had to say it.
That was beautiful.
Beautifully put.
Yeah. Jason, are you still awake?
Yeah. Okay. What?
No, it's just you didn't respond, so I thought I'd...
I'm hanging on every word, you asshole.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because you guys are kind of true believers, and that's the thing is that I had this fantasy for years. I didn't put it in the book, or maybe it was in an early draft, but I had this fantasy that if I could have just gotten Ronald Reagan stoned, and really stoned, and had him listen to some Gil Scott-Heron, that like his policies, and it's a silly idea, but it was really, I really was possessed by this, because, you know, as much as people think, you know, Bush W. was awful, like, you know, he was just, the groundwork was laid by Reagan in terms of, are we going to be a totally phony, morally negligent country? Yes, we can. That was Reagan. And when that was happening and the country was sort of turning in that direction towards sort of self-regard and I have my stuff and screw you if you don't have any stuff, and if you're poor, you must be poor because it's your fault, not because I have anything to do with it, you know, that basic attitude and dynamic, I just had this sense that if I could have gotten Reagan stoned and made him listen to Gil Scott-Heron, he just would have really become a more compassionate figure, moral figure. And he would have gone, you know, the crisis of the inner city in this country is my crisis and I'm going to solve it. You know, we wouldn't have a war on drugs. We would have you know, war on poverty, which we did have, you know, in just a few years before Reagan came along. In some sense, Reagan was a reaction to that. And I think that, you know, in other words, I'm a big believer in the possibility of music as a humanizing force. And I love it when, that, you know, for instance, you go to a concert and, you know, you see some, you know, you see somebody who you think, oh, I'm not going to like that person. For me, it would be like somebody driving a big SUV with a bumper sticker saying, you know, you'll pry this my gun for my cold, dead hands or whatever. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm not going to have anything in common with this person, and I don't like his values, and I'm sure he wouldn't like my values. I better just not say anything loud enough that he's going to punch me. But, you know, the amazing thing about a concert is when the music starts, you might see that same dude doing his goofy noodle dance, and you go, yeah, he's a human being too, man. If I could just somehow reach him, that part of him, you know, that whose compassion has been awakened by this music, you know, if I could somehow trap that and apply it to the other parts of his life, we'd just be in a, whatever, a far kinder and gentler and more merciful country. You know, it's never going to happen, but that's really what I think music is intended to do, is to make people feel like Dick Cheney must have a kind of music. It's probably Wagner in his case, but at any rate, you know, he's got to have a kind of music that makes him.
Wagner is light music for Cheney. That's what he puts on.
You think he's, yeah, you know what? Cheney's probably into the black metal. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, we'd have to see how our relationship with Norway was during the Bush years, if there was like special considerations that were given to them in terms of trade, then we know that Dick Cheney is a big black metal fan.
Yeah. Well, all you have to do is really just check their oil reserves and you can get a great immediate sense of what was Cheney's posture towards this particular part of the world. But yeah, I mean, and I don't mean to go off on any political, it's just, to me, it's sort of connected. And part of the reason that I'm so sort of glad to be able to write about music is because I'm writing about art, you know, and I'm trying to advocate, as you guys do, I think, very sort of eloquently, that this is not something to make you feel like a big shot or a snob or whatever. It's like this is one of the few untarnished pleasures and humanizing pleasures that we have left. And, you know, we need to kind of reach each other through these things, because they're really when we're at our best and most sort of our defenses are down, in a way.
Well, Steve, I think for all the talk that you've done about how difficult it is to describe how music makes us feel, I think that's you've actually done that exceptionally well today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think about it. I mean, I just think about this stuff all the time, and try to think. You know, songs were making their ways into my short stories. There's a whole chapter of the book that's about how kind of just listening to musicians made me realize, look, you know, this is how you write. You've got to be emotional. You've got to grant yourself the right to be emotional and say the things that matter to you and quit lying and quit trying to be sophisticated and strike a sophisticated pose. And, you know, all the stuff that we've talked about is a sort of complex of ways of not feeling the deepest stuff that you're feeling. Music is the one place where you're completely not just allowed, but really forced in some way. I've certainly had the experience of like just listening to music and being led into feeling, usually for me, just like starting to get very upset and cry or whatever. But it doesn't feel bad, actually. It feels good. It feels good because it's in there anyway. And the fact that you finally identified it and connect to it and experience it is more pleasure. So it's such a relief in a weird way. But then I also remember that the only times I've really been consistently happy, I mean consistently, like euphoric, is just when I've been listening to music. You know, it's just without music there, it's impossible for me in most instances to reach those feelings that, you know, are kind of the reason that you bother being alive, to be honest.
Steve, you talk in the book about music being about the days when music was a concerted sonic experience. Yeah. I was wondering, with all the music that you have in your serial killer basement and all the music you've written about, how difficult it is, if it is difficult, for you to have those kinds of experiences these days, and what recently for you has given you that kind of experience?
Well, you know, it is, the reason it's tough now is because for years and years I was a just a bachelor, you know, and I was in my apartment alone all the time. And this is another thing that I think is a selecting factor for who becomes susceptible to music in this way. You know, having an older sibling who has better taste than you is a big deal, and having people feed you good music along the way. But I think also it's a lot of it is just being lonely and you know, being the kind of person for whom it's tough to reach your feelings. And so music is sort of there to make you feel less alone with certain feelings and allow you to experience them. And I was doing that all the time when I was just kind of on my own, and that's, music was kind of like my best friend, really, for a lot of years. But now that I have a wife and two little kids, you know, neither of us get the chance to listen to music just to sit there and listen to music. I still listen to it all the time in my office when I'm writing. I have earbuds in, you know, but then I'm also trying to do other sorts of work. The opportunity for me to just listen to a tune and that's it is incredibly rare. I would say, you know, I do it on airplanes, but then, you know, you've got this roar in the background, you know, and you're sort of squeezed into a seat. It's not the same as being 10 years old and, you know, or a teenager and getting baked and just listening to Dark Side of the Moon, man. And that's like the full activity, man. And it's like almost too much to listen to that album because so much is happening in there. And, you know, it's not impossible at this point in my life, but I look back on that opportunity and go, oh man, at some point the kids are going to get older and it's going to get easier for me. I will say though, in terms of a good album can always do that. So I've been listening to this Florence and the Machine record recently, and I just think it's outstanding. And it, you know, it's one of those deals, you guys all feel this way, where I just look forward to, I wake up and I'm like, oh cool, I get to listen to that album again today, you know. So that's one that's been doing it for sure. And I've been building a bunch of, because it's Mother's Day, so I've been building a couple of you know, compilations for people, for like, you know, our neighbor, you know, who's a mom, and so that's been a delight, because I've been able to sort of basically cherry pick a bunch of songs, and then I listen to the soundtrack. This is going to be weird, but do you guys ever do this where I'll make a mix CD for somebody and I'll give it to them, and then as soon as I give it to them, I run back to my house and listen to it, and I imagine them listening to it.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It's kind of pathetic, but
no, that's how I courted my wife. That's how, you know, I made, as I was making it, I imagined her reaction, and then once I gave it to her, I went back and did it again.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these deals where, again, it's almost as if you're saying to the person, like, I'm trying really hard to reach you, and I want you to feel the same things that I feel when I listen to this song, because then I feel like I'll be closer to you. You know, I there's a term I use in the book, which is not maybe the nicest term, but it's like being a drooling fanatic is like Asperger's with a backbeat.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
it's perfect.
In some ways, as much as like on the page, I try to be really emotionally honest, but I'm really also kind of nervous and awkward, and music, you know, it's the Cyrano idea. It really does sort of speak more eloquently than I can about my feelings a lot of times. And I think that's what those mixed CDs are about, that I feel like, okay, well, like, I know I'm kind of a nervous, geeky guy, but here, check this out. You know, this is what's happening inside. I'm this sexy, you know.
Right. And the hope that you have that they're going to pick up on what you're listening to. I remember making a mix for my wife, my girlfriend at the time, and I put on a song called He's My Best Friend by Jellyfish, and I wanted her so bad to listen to the lyrics and go, this song is about masturbation. And
yeah.
she never did it. And I when I think about it now, I still get upset to this day that, like, it never got to the point where she was like, oh, that's why you put this song on there. You're being clever,
yeah.
You know. You wanted to share that wink with me.
Right, yeah. You're trying to tell me that you masturbate a lot.
Right.
Awesome.
She knew
but,
that.
You know, Jellyfish is a great, that record, Spilt Milk, is one of the all-time under-recognized beautiful records.
Oh.
And, you know, people don't understand. It's like the Beatles made, you know, they just popped out a little baby who made, like, not as great an album as the Beatles made. I'm not going to say that, but it's a masterpiece, a pop
yeah.
masterpiece. Oh. Anyway, we'll go too far into that cul-de-sac. But every time, it's not a lot of people who know Jellyfish. They're a relatively obscure band, but man, that one album. They had a couple of other, you know, like they had other albums as well. But that was the one I feel like where they just that Mersey pop sound. They just nailed it.
Yep, that's one of those albums I still go back and listen to have that concerted sonic experience that you speak about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's tough now. In this, you guys know this, and you know, now it's tough to even have the experience of listening to a whole album.
Right.
You know, if people talk a lot about, oh well, modern, you know, everything's moving faster, and our intellectual and emotional metabolisms are all sped up. And the clearest example of that, or at least a very concrete example, is, you know, the unit of music that by which a band is judged has become the song. You know, and maybe it's become the ringtone. You know, maybe we're there. But it used to be the album and even a double album. I listened to Songs in the Key of Life for the entirety of 1974. And I didn't just listen to Sir Duke. You know, I listened to Village Ghetto Land and Ebony Eyes and, you know, I mean, the obscure songs on the other album. And they, too, were kind of a part of the experience. When I'm being depressive about it, I go, oh, okay, I get it. This culture is just never going to get back the capacity to pay attention as carefully as we used to. I don't think that's true. I think we're just letting those muscles are just going, they're not atrophying, they're just, you know, we're going to lard in our capacity to pay attention. But I think it's possible to get it back. And, you know, I do listen, I try to make it a habit anyway, of listening to a whole album two or three times through, because oftentimes a track that passes you completely the first time, because it's a little more nuanced, a little more subtle, it's not as hit you, you know, right on the nose, is the one that really takes root.
That I always say is the mark of a great album, one where any song, or pretty much every song, can be your favorite track at any given time.
Yeah, that would be a good, because I anguished over, like, what am I going to choose as my desert island playlist at the end, and that was the thing, is I was like, oh my god, like, what do I do? How do I make this decision out of the thousands of albums that I really, really love, or at least hundreds that I love. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty much got to be the criteria. I've got to feel that that's a solid record. There got to be no duds on this record.
Well, how many songs do you think you fell in love with because you were... I have a long list of these songs that I fell in love with because I was just too lazy to lift the needle or hit fast forward.
Yeah. Yeah, no, especially when you're listening to cassettes, you know, which were such a hassle, the forward and rewind. Like, everybody has the pain. I don't know how old you guys are, but I'm old enough that was like my central high school, college, like the cassette was the configuration. And I mean, how frequently do you say, wait, dude, it's right here. Fast forward, hold on. You know, like, where you're trying to get to the beginning of the killer track you want somebody to hear. It's like I probably spent a combined, you know, 6 months doing that of my life, just fast forwarding and saying, wait, dude, you got to hear this.
Yeah, and then I remember during the advent of CDs, feeling like, oh my god, you know, just the way that I am listening to albums has changed so dramatically. Yeah. Like, I don't have to sit and listen to this song anymore, so I'm not going to. I'm just going to hit a button. And now it's advanced even. Or
I'm not going to download it, right?
Right. I'm not going to stream it.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. That's So, and that all this stuff. I mean, technology. I kind of, you know, it basically just makes people sound like grandparents. Like, that's kind of its central job is to make distraction profitable and make everybody sound like they're 95. But you know, when you look at anything concrete, any sort of cultural artifact, it just immediately does that. And you're like, I try to explain to people who have their entire catalog, music catalog, and can reach any other kind of music on a device the size of a candy bar, like, yeah, long ago there was this, you know, there was this thing, the boombox, see, and you could carry it on your shoulder and walk around with music, and it was like, that was impossible before that. It's like trying to talk with, you know, my daughter about, like, the time before she was alive. She just doesn't register for her. She's like, what?
Yeah, I remember, you know, for me, like, with the iPod, that was the beautiful thing, being able to carry it, because I, you know, I'd always carry my CDs with me and a Discman, and just, you know, I'd have to know what I was going to be in the mood to listen to that day, you know, before going to work. And now it's just like, oh, whatever's at my, you know, now I keep my entire record collection in my shirt pocket.
Yeah. Which is cool. And again, if you'd told me about this like device when I was 14, I would have been like, okay, you're the Messiah. Okay. tell me what I need to do to get to heaven. But I think what's happened also, which people don't take account of, is that, you know, we've really lost the feeling of yearning and of all the inconvenience that is, in fact, evidence of how much you love something and how important it is to you. So, in other words, the ritual of deciding which CDs you were going to listen to and packing them up was, I'm going to guess anyway, kind of a pleasurable one. It was an inconvenience on the one hand, but also it was like a chance to do what every drooling fanatic loves to do, which is go, oh, yeah, I want to listen to some of this today. Yeah, man, I'm in the mood for a little Paul Thorne, and yeah, you know, how about some Dana Kurtz, and yeah, this album, and, you know, like, I find it's a great pleasure to sort of go through all, it's like, you know, Scrooge McDuck or something, go through all my CDs and consider all the beautiful music. And I think people... As an 8 or 9 year old listening to the radio and waiting for a particular song to come on, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And when that song came on, the feeling that I had was such a sense of gratitude and wonder at like my good fortune and the good fortune that I was alive to hear Undercover Angel.
We perked up when you mentioned Undercover Angel.
Yeah. It's great. It's another one of these songs. It's like straight cheese, but it's just such delicious cheese, you know?
And the other thing is, you know, I'm pretty sure you mentioned the book, the act of going to the store, picking something out, and then going home to listen to it. You know, that is something that has completely been lost. So you don't get that anticipation that, sitting down with the record and bonding with it, with headphones, reading the lyric sheet, reading the liner notes and figuring out who plays, that has been kind of lost, I think.
That ties in with the unrequited musical longing that you talk about, you know, when you couldn't get the album or hear any of the tracks beforehand, so you had to live in anticipation of that release date that you heard about from the record store, and you had to rearrange your day so you could go down and get it right when the store opened. And
oh, yeah. And, you know, you couldn't listen to music in school when we were growing up. When I am 43, you know, it just wasn't even possible. And you couldn't even always use the record player because that was an expensive piece of equipment. It was fragile. And there were limits. And those limits they invested the music with the feeling that we should have about it, which is that it's sacred and that we're lucky when we get access to it. And I feel like I think it's great maybe on some level that we can get everything we want at one click away. But I feel like, you know, you just don't appreciate the music as much when it's so easy to get at. And, again, it's not like a kid these days. I think kids are still having deep, profound, amazing, emotionally moving experiences with music. I don't think that has gone away. But I think certain kinds of experiences around music of not, you know, the inaccessibility and the inconvenience of it, we're really our allies in terms of appreciating how amazing that music is. And that's what all those, you know, vinyl listeners are squabbling about. It's not that they're like, oh my God, I just must have me, or the part of them that is saying, oh, the audio sound of the actual original recording is so much better. Like, that's a boring conversation I don't want to have with the ham radio club. Like, I'm not interested in that discussion. But I do agree with them that the reason I liked, you know, the old way was because you had to wait and your longing was given a chance to kind of ferment and, you know, get, you know, make you, and the sense when the music finally came was, you know, there was an appropriate sense of gratitude. You know, that's what I think people are, and, you know, the worst critics or the worst fans, they just don't have any gratitude for how blessed they are to be, you know, to have this music in their lives. And I hope that the one thing I really hope will happen is that people will just remember how lucky they are. I hope they'll find the artist that I write about in the book. But even if not, even if that's like, I don't want to listen to your music, I got my own music, I hope they'll just recognize how sort of friggin' lucky we are to be living in, you know, a time where we can listen to such an incredible variety of music and dependably feel the things that we can feel almost nowhere else at this point.
We're all just kind of speechless.
Yeah, we are. I think you've really summed up pretty much everything that the three of us have gone through in our musical history. So.
Yeah, we we're that's the thing is that I don't know how this book is going to reach other people of our kind of crazy little tribe, but I know that they would enjoy it if they found it. You know, it's really hard to get a book out there. It's much harder than an album or anything else, you know, because it's a book and it's sort of out on the cultural margin. But I sort of, I feel like I wanted to, like the one audience that I want to reach, even if it's not a great big audience, is the, you know, people like us who are like, yeah, we just, we're too into it. But like, it's not, that's not going to change, you know, and I really hope that there's some way in paperback or as the book moves out into the world that by word of mouth, whatever, that, that the book finds all the, you know, people like us who aren't going to like, you know, even if we sound like dorks or whatever it is, we're going to admit that we're completely worship, you know, we just worship music.
Well, the book is like a, it's like a good album in that way. I mean, I'm playing a benefit concert with the band next week, and I've bought copies of the book for each of them as a thank you.
Because, oh, that's awesome! Yeah.
Well, I feel like they're the kind of people that would enjoy this book and will read it, and then they will in turn, because I thought of a lot of them, and they're going to read it, and they're going to think of their friends that they had their own shared musical experiences with, and it'll it'll move on down the line.
Yeah, well, that's the hope. I mean, that's the best, you know, that's the best thing that can happen, and it's sort of like all the great music I've gotten access to, or most of it, has come from, you know, some kind of personal recommendation. Like somebody tipped me off. That's why I started doing my own dorky little e-zine, The Tip, because I felt like there's this sort of understanding in the world of people who care about art, various art forms excessively. And I feel like we should all be connected, not by Facebook or, you know, some, but just by our, you know, somehow getting access to one another and being able to, even if it isn't directly, that I say to you, you've got to get Salesman and Racist, and you say, well, Almond's pretty fucking full of shit, but I like some of his other tasty music. So then you get Salesman and Racist, and then you pass it along, you know what I mean? And by the time we're done, Kevin Bacon has a copy of Salesman and Racist.
And now it's time for the endorsement section, where each of us will recommend something that has been on our mind lately, and Steve is going to be participating in this as well. So let's start with him. Steve, what's your endorsement for today?
I'm going to recommend a book, and I'm going to recommend the book. It's a book called Stoner. I found out about this book in grad school. I, of course, thought it was about marijuana use and felt a deep sense of betrayal when I realized it was not about marijuana use, which hasn't entirely gone away. But I guess that leaves room for me to write the memoir about marijuana use. So I've made my peace with it. But the book Stoner is, if I tried to describe the plot, it would sound totally boring because it's just the story, kind of quiet story of one a guy who's, you know, an academic and sort of the travails of his life and the unhappy marriage and intrigue at the little university he works at. It sounds totally boring if I tried to describe the events of the book, but it's the most devastatingly sad and beautiful book. It might be the perfect novel, and barely anybody knows about it. It went out of print for a long time. And it's the kind of book, I'll just explain it like this. I recommend it always to younger writers who are looking for a novel because they never heard of it. And, it needs the help. It needs to get out there. And I recommended this young woman, and she sent me an email a couple of weeks later, and she said, oh, I was reading Stoner, but I just reached this one particular scene. I knew the exact scene she meant, and it was just too sad to read. I couldn't go on. I'm sorry, but it's so beautiful, but it's just too sad. I've been having these problems with my boyfriend. We're trying to move, blah, blah, blah. I said, fine. Hey, at least she felt the book, and, you know, some books should be so sad you can't get through them. But then a couple of days later, she sent a second email saying, oh, you know, Stoner's really sad, but I couldn't stop reading it. I'm so glad I finished it, and it's just completely changed the way I kind of look, you know, looking at things. And so people should try to find that book.
Okay, and who's it by?
It's, yeah, thank you, Stoner. Just Stoner by a stoner.
Okay.
It's by a guy who was too stoned to remember his, to actually
stoner
have his,
by Mr. Doritos.
Right, exactly. Stoner by Oreos. It's by a writer named John Williams. He passed away a few years ago, but he only wrote a few books, and this is like the merit, you know, this is the, to me, the transcendent. This is the spilt milk of his career. It's just this masterpiece. So it's John Williams, not the Star Wars guy.
Okay. Well done.
You know my baby, she won't let me in. I've got a few pennies, I'm gonna buy myself a bottle of gin. And then I'm gonna call my buddy on the telephone and say,
Jeff?
Yes, sir. Well, I've already seen the season of the show that I'm going to recommend because I'm stuck out in the sticks with no choice but to have DirecTV. But I would like to remind everybody that Friday Night Lights is back on NBC. And if you're not watching it, you should be. One of the best shows on television.
Well, I'm a long, tall Texan. I wear a 10-gallon hat. Son, I wear a 10-gallon hat.
He rides from Texas, wear a 10-gallon hat.
When people look at me and they say, oh, Lord, is that your hat?
He rides from Texas, wear a 10-gallon hat.
And Jason?
Yeah, I'd like to recommend the TV show Breaking Bad on AMC, which is currently in its third season. I just recently caught up on all the episodes because I hadn't watched it before. So it, just to briefly describe the plot, it's about this chemistry teacher, high school chemistry teacher named Walter White, who's played by Bryan Cranston, who played the father on Malcolm in the Middle, in a very different role for him. Basically, the plot is he's diagnosed with inoperable lung cancer and decides to turn to cooking meth in order to provide for his family. And the show is brilliantly acted, often difficult to watch, but absolutely compelling. So you should go get the DVDs, or you can get them on iTunes, and then head over to our friends at Bullseye.com. One of our writers, our Popdose writers, Will Harris, has done a great job of interviewing almost everybody from the cast, as well as going to visit the set, and has some really in-depth looks at the behind the scenes of the show. So Breaking Bad on AMC.
You've become such a mess, you and your crystal meth. You lost your family, wrecked your truck. I used to love you, now you suck. We were friends among the best, you and your crystal meth.
Okay, and for my endorsement, on May 4th, a handful of albums came out by some of my favorite acts: Josh Ritter, New Pornographers, Justin Curry of Delamitri.
Air Supply.
All of them are excellent, and I recommend them, but because we're talking about the drooling fanatics, I'm going to recommend Heaven Is Whenever by The Hold Steady. The song in particular, the song from which the title is taken, which is called We Can Get Together, he's talking about how his girlfriend is always talking about heaven through song lyrics. He says, heaven is the whole of the heart and paradise is by the dashboard light. And then in the chorus, he just really sums up everything that we've been talking about on this show. He says, heaven is whenever we can get together, sit down on your floor and listen to your records. And so that is my endorsement for this show.
They're a great band. And I love also Hello Starling by Josh Ritter.
Yes.
Is an amazing record. And then this is a true drooling fanatic moment, is the first Delamitri record, that very first one it's probably just called Delamitri, which is,
right,
I think, very difficult to find.
Yeah, it is.
I think I mentioned in the book even, is it just a perfect pop record? I mean,
you
people,
do, yeah.
Nobody's ever heard it, but anybody who does will be so happy.
There's a girl. To her cabin still. She said, whose good do got huge? But they started in St. Paul. Do you remember? Makes no sense at all.
band. They sang "What Is the Answer." I think they'll probably write "Let It Shine Down on Us All."
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Pop Does Podcast. I'd like to thank Steve Almond for being our guest today. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you,
yeah,
Steve.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find him online at stephenalmonds.com. And be sure to go to Pop Does every day for the latest pop culture news. Our discussion of Drooling Fanatics doesn't end here. Go over to the show notes and leave a comment about how you became one. And also in the show notes, you'll find links to buy Steve's books and all the other things that we've discussed today, and a link to the Facebook page for fans of the podcast. If you are new to the show, you can find the previous 8 episodes over at iTunes. And as I say every month while there, please leave a review because it helps give the show greater exposure. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/popdose. And we will be back next month. And Jason and Jeff, what should we talk about for June?
Father's Day? I don't know. We haven't gone that direction yet.
Okay.
we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
Okay.
Steve, I hope this book inspires a sequel where you talk more about, because you only touched on this briefly, that you find Tony Tennille hot.
Yeah. Oh, man.
That only got one line in the book, and I was really disappointed. Yeah. Just FYI.
Love will keep us erect.
Perfect.
I'd like to do that to her one more time.
Wah wah.
As a tribute to Billy Joel, Jason just got all of his money ripped off.
Huh?
Okay. That was, I don't know, I was trying to say.
I didn't get it.
I was trying to say, you know,
that he was swindled.
You're so in love with Billy Joel that you'd
entered
into bad investment schemes. Yeah. Stuff,
okay.
Or something like that.
Right.
Or that Jess's brother does your finances.
I just bought a motorcycle and tipped it over.
You didn't drive drunk, but you just tipped over a motorcycle.
I love Billy Joel so much, I just fired my drummer.
And now you're going to read every negative comment that every Pop Dose reader has ever left on one of your posts. And
tear it up at a concert. Tear it up at a concert.
Well, technically we did when we got rid of –
Oh, that guy, right.
The guy who didn't like the Acoustic 80s mention.
Acoustic 80s reference. Yeah.